Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 in the Good Beer Seal. It's December 18th, 2012. It's almost Christmas. And I'm here doing a pre-record with Tony McGee from Lagunitas. And Mark, what's your last name, Mark?
Mark Slukic.
Mark Slukic, the Lagunitas rep. So we're going to talk about beer here on Beer Sessions Radio. And welcome to Beer Sessions Radio. I'm joined by the co-founder and warlord of one of the fastest growing craft breweries in America. He really makes it all the way out to New York, so I'm happy to welcome, again, Tony McGee of Lagunitas Brewing to the Heritage Radio Network studio. Tony, welcome to the show.
All right. Good to be here, man. It's cool.
You know what? Your good buddy Dave Broder from Blind Tiger told me a lot about you, and I've got a couple of secret questions for you, because I'm going to try to push your button today.
But, can I demur if I need to?
Whatever you need to do. Okay. So, Lagunitas, it's seems to me it's one of those brands that has a great national footprint. People know it. They love it. You've got some great reps like Mark and Trevor who support the arts, and you guys are growing. And tell me the culture of Lagunitas, and what was it that got you started in the first place?
Oh, man.
Big questions, but it's your show.
It was a whole series of poor decisions, one piled on the other. The truth of the matter is, when I founded the brewery back in 93, it was kind of one of those bottom-of-the-barrel moments. You know, it's like I was in a different industry before selling commercial printing, and it was grinding quickly to a halt following the Gulf War and some of the other messes in the world. And I was just I was 18 months married, pretty sure I wouldn't be married even another day or two, and that was happily worked itself out. But today my wife runs the plant and does all the logistics, but that on top of all of a sudden owing about $50,000 in state and federal income tax and all kinds of stuff was going wrong, I just thought, shit, you know, okay, there's nowhere to go but up from here. What would I like to do? Then about Christmas time, my little brother gives me a home brewing kit in 1992, and brewed it in February, and that was that's it. I mean, it was more of a seizure, I think, than it was the fulfillment of a dream. I'm like, by December that year, the brewery was open.
So you like beer a lot.
I barely liked beer at all. You can hardly call me a beer geek. It's funny, you know. I mean, growing up in Chicago as I did, you know, you're going to drink old Milwaukee and old style, and you're going to... Yeah, cheers.
We're toasting.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was just no beer to be drunk. I remember having had an Anchor Steam in a bar in Evanston once back, probably in about 1983, and thinking it was something of a revelation. I guess that stuck with me. But we started drinking at a place called the Marin Brewing Company, you know, and I'm looking back at the stainless steel tanks behind the window and thinking they look pretty freaking sexy, and gear is sexy. And so when I brewed that homebrew batch, I'm like, oh, look, you know, I can do this. I put together about $30,000 out of the bank account without asking what I thought would be my future ex-wife, and started buying equipment. I bought a whole frickin' brew house for $5,000 from it was supposed to have been shipped to Russia, and somebody canceled an order, and I was in business was brewed in February, opened the brewery in December, and then by December of the next year, we had to move the place because we killed a septic system, and it was either like leave the whole business with my tail between my legs and be embarrassed, or just, you know, move the plant to Petaluma and go deeper into debt. And that was the beginning of 13 years of being chased down the street by wild dogs. I mean, just trying to stay ahead of bankruptcy and disillusionment and, you know.
So why did you move to Petaluma?
Well, like I said, we killed a septic system in this little tiny town out in West Marin where I lived. I lived in the town of Lagunitas, which is a little town. It's a wide spot on the road. There's a sign. One side says, welcome to Lagunitas. The other side says, thanks for visiting. And we lived up the hill off the main road, and I put the brewery in this little building right next door. And we were there for about 8 months. And one day the septic system looked up through the drain and said, leave, boys. And, you know, we took it at its word, and the county got intervened. Actually, the truth is, the septic, one time running off a mash, the groundwater got kind of warm, and so it took a long time. As I was running off the wort from the kettle going to the fermenter, the groundwater was a little warm, and so it took a long time to run it off. And in other words, a lot of water, and we filled up the septic tanks, and it flooded this little cabin that was immediately below the brewery. And their toilets came up through the floor, and the county came to see that, and they came to see us, and it was time to go.
I think if I had to pull a moral from the whole story, if you guys are still looking to do some last second Christmas shopping, get a homebrew kit. You never know what it'll turn into, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's true. Well, hey, take a side digression. We're drinking Lagunitas IPA, which is on tap out here at Roberta's in Bushwick, where we're recording. What's the story of Lagunitas IPA? When did that become one of your beers?
The story is it's pretty linear. First beer we made was a pale. I mean, when we first started off doing private label beers, and that was in West Marin, and they didn't have our name on it. Lagunitas didn't have its own label. There was no plan ever to do that. I was going to be a cabinet shop making beers one at a time, and I was going to be delivering them to these accounts that would have their own name on it where Lagunitas is. It's a real tourist intensive area, so the bars wanted to have their own identities and stuff. It's cool. And all the people that ever drank were from out of town. They were visiting, you know, from, you know, Dusseldorf and Fort Lauderdale and beyond. And so, but when we had to move to Petaluma, I realized we had to have our own label. And so I thought, well, what can I make? And I thought we could make a pale ale because outside of Sierra Nevada, nobody else in California made one. And I thought, well, there's people drinking pale ales. I could probably make a living doing this for a time if we had to. So we made a pale ale, we made a stout, and the pale ale had the dog on it. The stout was Bugtown Stout, and it had a little roach on it. And but what we realized pretty quickly was that, you know, Sierra Nevada was such a profoundly, you know, beloved brand that selling a pale ale against them was just unflattering to us, and it probably wasn't even really that productive, and it didn't feel good. So I thought, well, you know, you always want to be selling up, always be selling up. And I thought to myself back in, you know, late 94, well, what's up, you know, from an IPA? And you start looking around, and nobody back then on the West Coast, with exception of Bridgeport Brewing up north, and you know, Anderson Valley made a nice IPA, but nobody had one as a flagship with the exception of Bridgeport. So I thought, well, there's some open field running. We can do this. And so we made this beer, and it is now largely as it was then without any changes. The beer was, we did it as a seasonal to commemorate our 100th brew, and it immediately became a permanent package, and quickly we moved our business to orient around that as our future. And I had the feeling that 10, 15 years out, that IPAs would be what the whole industry would be about. And it's funny, because I thought, well, this is good. So if we get a head start on it, you know, we could take a shortcut and maybe we'll, you know, have a storefront that we can talk to people from if we do it now. And we did, and now it is as that way. I wish it wasn't quite so crowded, but, you know, it's great having a lot of peers, and it's cool to have been right, and I think it's all worked out good. We make a lot of other beers as well, you know, but those beers are all kind of the pilot light under the IPA. That's how we look at it, you know. It kind of keeps the IPA vital by making the Maximus and Little Something and all the seasonals, the Hairy Eyeball and the Brown Sugar and all the rest of it. So that's the creative juices that keep the IPA flowing.
All right. You've had some controversial labels as well.
Oh, some kind of. Yeah. Yeah. Well, like the Censored Ale, you know, originally called that the Chronic, and sent that label off. This is not too long after 9/11, and the ATF was like, their ATF at the time, they were scanning everything that came in because they expected there to be anthrax in it. And we'd get our approvals back, and the paper would be so irradiated that everything that was in the envelope was that the paper was yellow and coming apart. I mean, that, like, the paranoia was 1,000 miles deep, but it also would take them months to respond. And we submitted the label with the Chronic on it, and, you know, Chronic means a lot of things, but, you know, in our world, it was starting to mean like the best of anything. It was like a new skateboard mood or move or an album, or, you know, it was a cool new movie that was out. And because it started off as, you know, the idea was it was the best possible weed. But then things move out. It's like, you know, one time it was like, oh, yeah, man, that's good shit. You know, now it's like, oh, that's the shit. It could be anything. It moves out into the popular culture. Well, so we sent this label in and made the beer and sold it. And it did well. And people thought the name was fun. And the next day, I'm not getting a rejection from the ATF. And I called the guy. I'm like, dude, you know, he said, oh, I looked it up in the National Institute of Health's database. And actually, on the East Coast, out this way, it meant strong pot mixed with crack. And I was like, oh, I'm with you. Okay. We don't want to promote that either. So, but I didn't like the censorship thing, so I took the word censored and put that over it and sent it back in more to thumb my nose at the guy. And instead, he approved it. I was like, all right. It's good to know how things work.
But that's a good beer. So it's a censored. That's the copper ale, right?
Yeah.
So why did you decide to make that style separate from the story of the label?
It was just everyone was making an amber ale, and I just wanted to make an ale that had like a hoppy note to it, and was a little bit of color and kind of a little richness on the caramel side. But you don't want to call it amber. I mean, you don't want to call it a red ale. But copper ale is like, we felt like that. Nobody did that then. It was like, okay, it's copper, because that was kind of the color too. It was like, like polished copper. So we're like, okay, we're pretty literal, If I made a beer and it was blue, we'd probably just call it blue, I don't know. It seemed easy.
Well, Mark, what's it like being a rep and you're the East Coast rep now or the New York State rep?
No, it's covered New York State, Jimmy.
New York State. And how do people respond to Lagunitas?
Really great. It's kind of a funny story. When I started about 3 years ago, not many people out here could pronounce the name of the brewery, let alone, knew what it was or where we were from. But, nowadays, man, it's, really kind of penetrated the culture in a big way. And it's cool to see. And cool to see that we have so many fans that dig the beer, more so than anything. And kind of just happened organically for us out here. It's been a cool story.
Yeah, and you've also developed, and we'll go back. We have a lot more to talk about with you, but you really have a great group of sales staff out here. There's Trevor, there's Mark.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you, this is like the culture of Lagunitas,
Yeah.
How does that, is that all about you and your buddies, or how do you develop this great team you have?
Ron Lindenbush and I were kind of sort of the foundations of it. Ron's extraordinarily gregarious. I mean, he just loves being with people and loves telling the stories, and he's a great speaker. And I'm sort of more like the ghost in the machine back at the brewery. And I for the longest time, I wrote all the recipes, and just recently I've sort of allowed Jeremy Marshall, my head brewer, to begin doing more of those. I mean, he wrote the Hop Stupid recipe, he wrote the Daytime recipe, and a little something something. So he's got his own voice. He understands these new hops. But anyway, the point is that I for the large part, I still art direct those recipes. So I'm kind of the point source for a lot of the brand. I design the labels right there on my Mac in my office. I write the copy and do all that stuff. And Ron was able to kind of take this and make it into a personality in the world. And I think that when if you're doing something that's authentic enough, people see their reflection in it. And I mean, I hope Mark feels that way, And I think that some of the other reps who come to us, including some of the management that has come to me I got Dartmouth MBAs. I signed their paycheck. I'm a music school dropout. It's kind of
Well, that's it. So you're a music school dropout.
Oh, yeah. Dropout. You think you could
So you're not just a business guy. You got a little bit of creativity.
Oh, yeah.
Well, it comes through.
Yeah.
So what did you study? What was your original
composition?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And the funny thing is that running a brewery is just like composition. But hang on. The thing is that when you get a cool thing going, if it's authentic, people see the reflection in it and they gravitate towards it. You become like a little black hole for people who have, interesting points of view. They're like, I understand these people. I bet they'll understand me too. And next thing you end up with a really cool crew. You're not looking for hired guns that are just going to walk up and down the street and pass out business cards and talk to bar owners. They're going to go in there, they're going to be themselves, and their self is just a lot like you. And it's authenticity is a word that gets thrown around in our industry. I'm not sure what authenticity even means, except that the word author is embedded in it. And if you are the author of your own story, then you're authentic. If you're just parroting something back that you've seen before, you saw on TV, or you read, then you're something else. So we have a lot of very authentic folk around the brand. That's a great joy. I mean, because it's critical to be able to tell your story. That's what beer is. Beer is telling a story. So like I said, composition is a lot like music. There's a story to be told. And if I'm writing 30-second TV commercial music, or if you're writing a symphony that's going to be 25 minutes long, it's a brand is a 20-year-long symphony. There's themes, there's restatement of the theme, there's developments, there's introduction of new themes, or you bring the old theme back in a new key, you bring it back in a different meter, and there's development, and the whole thing eventually coagulates, and you end up with all these themes in one place. That's a brand, and we just tell the story long and slow over time, and I treat the brand in that same way, like it's music. So I think that there's a lot. And on top of that, it's like if you sit down and write a piece of music, you write out all those little dots on those little lined pages, and then you hand it to a bunch of very skilled artisans, and they reproduce it back to you, and in doing so kind of inject their own self into it, their own particular worldview, their own set of skills, you know, their own deficiencies as well as the things they excel at. Well, when I write a recipe and I hand it off to my brewers, the same process occurs, and you hear it back. And if you have really fabulous musicians, the music you hear coming back to you is better than what you thought you wrote down. And so it is the same with the recipes for the beer. So
you're saying we should fund music education in America?
You know, I don't know anything about business except what I've learned, and everything I need to know in life I learned in music. You betcha. And it's all there, you know. Music's a fabulous thing. It's a language with no words. I mean, you know, how profound can a thing possibly be, you know? You don't even need the burden of meanings or memes behind meanings. It's just communication.
That's awesome. All right, we're here with Tony McGee from Lagunitas. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. Right now, just take a breather and.
You're listening to As Bad as It Gets by the Raunch Hands on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio at the Heritage Radio Network. It's our pre-Christmas episode, pre-recording for December 18th, 2012. We're just having pizza from Roberta's. We're having the margarita. And we're talking with Tony McGee, the founder, owner of Lagunitas. All right.
Good pizza.
That's the sound effect. Mark, what beer are we drinking? We're drinking something else. We're drinking a Christmas beer.
Yeah, we just cracked open an Evil Twin before, during, and after Christmas beer. It's the first time having this one, actually.
So, and you guys have some Christmas beers out from Lagunitas too. What do you have this year, Mark?
Well, this year, back in October, we released Brown Sugar for the first time in a couple of years, and unfortunately, we weren't able to do it last year due to some production restraints. But came back in full force, and you know, we're tapping it all over the place in New York City, everywhere else across the country, coming back in bottles as well. And following the Brown Sugar, we're going to have the glorious return of Lagunitas Sucks Holiday Ale, which Tony, I'm sure, can tell you a little bit more.
I love that name. I've never had it. Lagunitas Sucks.
Last year, because of all sorts of crazy capacity constraints we've experienced over the last 8 months, they're all resolved now. We realized we just couldn't make the Brown Sugar. It's a brew house hog. We make, you know, the brew house was 80 barrels, but we couldn't make more than 50 barrels of it at a pop, and it got to do a longer boil, and then it spends more time in the fermenters, and so it was like it made our brewery much smaller at a time when we actually needed it to be bigger. So we decided, rather than allocate it or do any of that usual kind of stuff the craft brewers feel like they have to do, I said, fuck it, we're not making this beer. Can I say that on the air? Is that all right? It's a podcast.
I think you
right?
just did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Podcast. I love them. But anyway, so we said, screw it. We're not gonna make it. Let's just put it aside. And I thought to myself, people are gonna be upset. I mean, some number of people are very passionate about the beers they expect to show up for seasonals. And the Brown Sugar, I mean, you know, love it or hate it, it has a really interesting, you know, profile. It's unusual in the year, and so people had a following. And so I was like, people are gonna be mad at us. And all of a sudden, it just appeared in my mind while we were sitting in this little meeting that it's like I've been driving into work for the last 15 years, and there's a local band in our area called Primus. They play all over the world, of course, but they're sort of housed up by us. And I was following behind this car so many days driving into the brewery with a bumper sticker that said Primus Sucks. And that was the band's bumper sticker. And I thought, man, that takes such balls to just say that. And I always wanted to say it. I was afraid it would catch on and people would go, yeah, well, I can just, it does kind of suck. You know? But with not doing the Brown Sugar, I was like, this is our moment when we could actually say, well, we suck. This whole thing blows, you know, we hope just for a quick and merciful end to everything. And, you know, there's no joy in our hearts this holiday, but we decided we'd make a beer that would also just like, you know, toast people's expectations about what a hoppy beer might be. And we had all these some experimental varieties and other things, and a couple special malts that we brought in that were only in limited quantities, and we made the sucks, and it just blew up. People dug it, and I think people liked the Lagunitas sucks, and us putting it on a label ourselves, and I took it away from everyone, so nobody could be mad at us, you know.
So with all the stories of other breweries expanding, you know, breweries going from the West Coast to the East Coast,
yeah.
And you guys are going to be opening. What are you going to open in Chicago? You're also expanding as well, aren't you?
Oh yeah. Putting in in Chicago, there's an old steel fabrication plant, not a pouring, you know, molten steel, but making I-beams, and it closed down in '97, and there's four buildings there that are 300,000 square feet apiece with like 50-foot ceilings, and this guy was turning a crazy Greek billionaire guy, 75-year-old chain smoker with more energy than me. He was turning it into a set of movie sound stages, and they do that Kelsey Grammer thing, Boss, there, that Showtime special, as well as Transformers and other movies. So it's a real working thing. But this one building on his site was too close to the railroad tracks, and but it had 57-foot ceilings, you know, and 100-foot open spans. It would be like putting a brewery in that building. It would be like putting a brewery in a field. You know, there's really no constraints there anymore, so I rented that back last March, and we've been working. All the permits actually are going into the city of Chicago this week, and the licensing's all in process, and everything goes right. We'll have a tap room open in that space in March. The brewing equipment shows up in July, and we'll be commissioned and making beer by October. And the real thing about it is that we're taking all this diesel out of the beer.
For 2013.
Yes, 2013, yeah. We're taking all this diesel out of the beer. If you drink a beer of ours...
Cheers to the new year, guys. It's almost Christmas.
Yeah, that's right.
Cheers to 2013. You can check out Lagunitas in Chicago.
Yeah. So it'll be happening. It'll be happening by then. It's going to be exciting. And it's the real thing, the coolest part about it is that right now we spend a ton of money on freight shipping beer from Petaluma to Denver and points east. Well, you know, it's like by putting the brewery in Chicago, my freight bill will go through the floor, and instead I can spend that money on bank debt. And so for the brewery, it'll really cost us nothing to build the brewery there in Chicago. Like, nothing. It's the weirdest little calculation, you know?
So you're also thus increasing capacity, too.
Yeah. Yeah, the brewery in Chicago will be identical equipment to the Petaluma plant. So at that point, when the Chicago brewery goes up, it was originally going to be one size, but it's a little bit bigger now, and we'll be at about 1.4 million in capacity. But that's to grow into over years, you know. So,
and you're okay with that? You think that's a good move for you guys?
Oh yeah, each of the plants will be operating at 200,000 barrels on the first day. So I mean, they're big breweries by themselves, and they're profitable. It's good. And in Chicago, we're going to have a direct relationship with the whole damn Midwest. It's going to be cool, you know. And the beer that we ship to New York, you know, will be fresher. The beer that we ship to Minnesota, Minneapolis, you know, there's no summer. Even refrigerated travel isn't as good as, like, drinking it close to the brewery. So, and you know, the thing is, I was driving home after the day that I finally said we're doing this at the plant. And it occurred to me that down the street from us in a town called Fairfield is a 3-million-barrel Budweiser plant. Well, they're 100 million barrels. One plant's only 3 million barrels. They're already doing this. You know, this is how beer is supposed to be done. This isn't, you know, the idea that craft breweries had to come from one certain place is just kind of antiquated. It's a nice idea, but the truth is, you want to drink fresh beer made near where you are. So
what the beer we're drinking, the Evil Twin, that's a whole other thing. It's kind of like a contract brewing or a gypsy brewing.
Gypsy, yeah, it's cool.
What do you think about those guys? You think that's cool? I mean, first of all, this beer, the Evil Twin, before, during, after Christmas. Let's have a little more of that. I'm drinking a lot more than you guys. Tony, you're doing a great job talking, and you didn't even finish your IPA.
I am. That's right.
So what do you think of this beer, Tony?
Oh, that's very nice. That's very nice. That's cool. Which brewery do they make it at? Do you know which plant? No?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I do not know. I mean, he makes some in Denmark, and I know he's living in Williamsburg now, and he's probably going to be collaborating over here, too.
Gypsy brewing's fascinating, you know? Of course, it's different from contract brewing. Contract brewing's, you know, where you make the decision that you want to be a marketing company and have a label and you know, have somebody else basically take the risk of operating a plant, borrowing to build it. You know, it's like you eliminate a lot of your risk and you sort of, you know, you offshore it into another business. And for my own reasons, it's like I could never have done that. It's like the risk is supposed to be your own, and that's the risk and the responsibility of the risk, not only to bank or to landlord, but to all of your employees who work there, and the career that they're making with you. You know, that's part of of the soul of being a company, let alone being a brewery, you know. And I would want to make sure that I was as close as I could be to that risk, as well as the joy of watching it actually flower as possible. But so there's some breweries who've done well with contract brewing, and so it's like these are just personal decisions. It's not judgment about anybody else. Gypsy brewing, though, is fascinating just because it's such a pirate thing to do, you know? It's not as if you're even just making it all at one brewery. You're kind of, you know, the brewer's experiencing people's plants, and it's like visiting foreign countries when you go to a different brewery, you know? It's a cool thing to be doing, I guess. You know?
It'd be a great way to travel.
It sure does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you guys do any collaborations, or do you have any other brewers come in and make beer at Lagunitas?
No. You know, we've had lots of opportunities to do contract brewing, and we've always just declined it. Even when I could have used the money, definitely used the money, I was like, no, we have to focus on what we're doing, and we have to become good enough at what we're doing to support ourselves and to pay our own bills. And because if we take a shortcut and focus in a different direction, it'll take our eye off the goal, which is to make the best beer we know how to make, to present it in the most fascinating way we can, and to learn about ourselves in the course of doing it. Period. It's as simple as that, you know. So we always said no, even when it was would have been useful.
So you've been able to grow with your own staff. Like with Ron, we had Ron on the show a couple times, Ron Lindenbush. He's been a great advocate for you guys. What is his official title?
Beer Weasel.
Beer Weasel. Yeah, that's what I thought.
That's right, yeah. There's never been anything else, actually. I mean, you could call him, you know, chief marketing officer. You could call him, marketing director. But the truth is, he's just a beer weasel. Right? And he's always like that. I called him that when we first did business cards, maybe back in 96 or 7, you know. It's like, I just did them on my computer, and we sent them off to Kinko's, you know. I just put it on there just to crack them up. And
yeah, it's funny, because, you know, I've asked Ron before, you know, where it came from. And he's like, you know, honestly, man, I can't remember. Yeah, so
right. It was like, it was always just meant to be. He was just waiting for someone to call him that, and then he'd be that.
So guys like Mark and Trevor, what are their names? What are their job descriptions?
Yeah, my official title, I think, on my cards is Living the Dream, which is pretty damn accurate, I think.
I don't know if you ever knew Pat Mace, one of our guys. His was corned beef and bail bonds, you know?
I think my all-time favorite is Jim Jacobs, the pony ride attendant.
Pony ride attendant. my favorite of all was fucking Know-It-All. That was
what was his job?
Oh, he was a salesman. But all you had to do is ask him, and he'd tell you, you know? So he knew it all.
And tell us more about the Petaluma. I mean, you guys are Lagunitas in Petaluma. I've never been to Petaluma. Is it in Marin County or Sonoma County?
So it's at the ass end of Sonoma County. So when all those people up there tasting wines and stuff are heading back south on Highway 101, they get pooped out right at the brewery. So we pick them up, and we cleanse their palates with some hops, and they stop by for tours. And it's a beautiful part of the world, though. Absolutely gorgeous there. So.
And I know there's some attractions. There's like the beer train. You've got some cool. I mean, it's worth a trip to Petaluma to go to your brewery. I've never been.
Yeah.
So what are some of the highlights of visiting Lagunitas?
Well, you know,
for like a consumer.
Well, first of all, it's just the landscape is beyond beautiful. I mean, the scene of northern Marin County and western Marin County out towards the coast, and Sonoma County, and then Napa over to the other side, is just. It's just pastoral. Like if you take pictures and you show people, they're like, oh, that's one of those paintings you buy at the flea market, you know. But it's just that picturesque. But then, you know, you get there, gosh, there's distilleries, you know, there's wineries, you know, more than you can count. There's, you know, there's ourselves, there's Dempsey's Brewing. There's now a couple nano breweries in Petaluma, you know, Hen House and 101 North, and there's Russian River right up the street from us, and there's Bear Republic further up the road than that, and Mendocino. You keep going, you get to North Coast Brewing and Anderson Valley. I mean, it's, you know, it's just an adult playground. I mean, but the distilleries are cool things all by themselves. You know, everything from brandy to people making wine and soju and stuff, and so it's a spectacular place to hang. Just wonderful.
Wow. And let's say spring's coming up, spring of 2013.
Yeah.
I want to visit your area. Do you have any festivals coming up or any special, you know,
I guess the next
consumer
one
events?
Be the Beer Circus, no?
Beer Circus comes about May, you know? I mean, it depends on how early you come. You know, there's a San Francisco Beer Week is just a monstrous set of, you know, kind of unusual events and stuff that go on. And You know, it's almost, the Bay Area is just a big adult playground. And it's such an incredible tourist destination that people come from all over the world. And because of that, they're all coming from all over the world all the time. And there's always just more things to do than you can shake a stick at, you know. So.
All right. Let's make a toast. We had some of the Evil Twin.
Yeah, like the Evil Twin very much.
Yeah. And, you know, talking about building your company and putting yourself on the line to have your own business, that's really inspiring. Tell us about how you're we're going to take a short break in a minute. But when we come back, we'll talk more about how you built the company and how you've turned over the reins to your brewer and some of the new beers he's made. Okay? We'll be right back on Beer Sessions Radio. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's almost Christmas. It's December 18th, 2012. And I give our thanks to GreatBrewers.com, our sponsor, and to the Good Beer Seal and Association of 41 New York City Good Beer Bars, GoodBeerSeal.com. All right, here we are with Tony McGee, founder and owner of Lagunitas, and Mark, who's the New York area rep. We're drinking some cool beers. We talked a lot about Lagunitas, how it got started, and now we're drinking an unusual can beer, Oscar Blues. It's like a wide mouth can bottle. Somebody brought me from Colorado.
Actually, a collaboration with Sun King Brewery.
Interesting. And it's a hoppy brown ale.
Yep, it's called the Deuce. Dropping the Deuce.
And it's in a can. So I'm supposed to ask you, Tony, what do you think about cans for craft beer?
Well, I think a lot of people are making beer in cans because it's an exciting thing. The thing that consumers really want from all of us brewers more than anything else is to fulfill their dreams, you know, to do things that they didn't even know they wanted us to do. And with so many breweries in the United States and more coming online, everybody's looking for an opportunity. Find where they're open. Like I said, when we make an IPA, nobody else made an IPA. So that was an easy choice. People are looking for open field running. And certainly cans create a difference because all the breweries that were there before were in bottles, right? So I think certainly with Dale's, I mean, it's kind of been a brilliant thing for him. It's really helped him grow his company. It's made all these cool things happen. And, you know, his employees are better off and they probably have better equipment and better benefits. I mean, so there's nothing wrong about it with a brewery, any particular brewery doing cans. I think I upset Dale with a comment I made about cans, but, you know, the funny thing about cans that most people don't quite get, and Dale doesn't necessarily do this as far as I've ever read any of their stuff, but it's like as they talk about it being greener. You know, aluminum is about as green as a fish riding a bicycle. You know, I mean, it just isn't. And aluminum, once it's aluminum, I guess it's all right. You know, when you recycle aluminum, from what I've read, about 40% of the aluminum goes up the stack. So the recovery rate in the recycling process isn't all that high. But the actual fact of it is there's no mineral that's mined on Earth called aluminum. And most people think that there is. And what aluminum is actually a refined product that comes from something else called bauxite. And bauxite, if you look on a map of where the bauxite mines are in the world, you will notice that there is not one in North America. And there's a reason for that. This is a protected place in a lot of ways. And bauxite is mined and involves enormous amounts of caustic to separate it, sodium hydroxide, the same stuff we clean our tanks with, to separate it from soil and such. And bauxite then is like refined and put into these big sheets. And a big electric current, enormous electric current, after first making it molten, is run through it in order to align, you know, all the molecules so that it becomes this, you know, this, you know, the metal that we know as aluminum. And so once it's aluminum, it's a great thing. But gosh, in the days before it's aluminum. And the only thing to know about all that is not that cans are bad, but that there are no panaceas, you know. Glass comes out of silica mines. Silica is essentially sand. Yes, there are big holes in the earth, but there's no, like, you know, sodium hydroxide. Like in Spain, I think it was in Spain, there was a, maybe it was in one of the Slavic countries, there was a big spill where a dam broke, and it spilled all this caustic into a, this was just a couple years ago, it ran through this entire town, burned people's feet off as it ran towards the Danube. And by the time it got to the Danube, it was buffered out enough, and the caustic high pH was all neutralized. But, I mean, these aren't nothing is a thing without a price. And that's that. So to talk about one thing being greener than another, the only thing greener than anything is homebrew, where you drink it right out of your fermenter with a straw. You know, that's green. And people want to do that, I'm all for them. You know, even if it means they buy less of our beer, that's all right, too. But so we'll be, and I said this, in the last brewery in the country to can. Doesn't mean we'll never do it. We'll pretty much be the last one.
Do you think the kegs draft is more green?
You know, draft is fabulously green. Oh, those stainless steel kegs go around and around and around and around. Ron Lindebusch makes a joke. He goes, yeah, we can. They're 15.5s and they're 7.5s. Yeah, they're just big. You know, they're not single serve.
I like draft beer. It's one reason I get out of the house and go to my bar every night is I really want to have a draft beer.
Yeah.
And I think it's definitely a different experience.
It is. But there's times when you want to drink at home. And what are you going to do? You have kegs in your house? Maybe you do. Some people do. Maybe yeah. You know, but yeah, kegs are the most fabulous sort of recyclable thing.
So what do you think of this beer? This is the Deuce Oscar Blues. It's in a weird shaped can.
Yeah.
It's a hoppy brown ale.
With
it's
a
not
screw,
bad, right?
With a screw top. No.
Yeah.
That's definitely an interesting beer.
It's tasty.
You know, I think it's definitely been a little bit of a trend lately. A lot of black IPAs and, you know, brown IPAs. They're starting to pop up left and right. You know, people kind of pushing the limits.
Yeah, but when something's a black IPA and a wheat IPA and a light IPA and what we call one a fractional IPA, after a while, are they even IPAs anymore? What at some point shouldn't that just kind of go away? You know, I mean, our beer bears no resemblance to an English India Pale Ale, you know, and so everything's drifted so far from the center. I think IPA is just now short for hoppy.
But earlier,
but I like BrewDog Brewing up. They made a beer called IPA is Dead
in Scotland. Right?
I love that. Yeah, at James Watson,
a little Nietzsche.
Yep, IPA is dead, and he wasn't wrong.
But when you said IPA was your first big beer,
yeah,
that's what made it for you.
Yeah.
So what made you feel like that had a future way back? What was it, the 90s?
Yeah. Well, you know, people were drinking pale ales and loving them, and they were hoppy. I mean, there's no two ways about it. You know, nowadays, you know, maybe people don't think of our IPA or Sierra Nevada as the, you know, as robustly hoppy, but I'll tell you what, in 1995, Sierra Nevada Pale Ale was one of the hoppiest beers anybody ever tasted. And so, you know, palates have evolved, as ours was at the time the hoppiest IPA anyone had ever tasted. And I don't know if it was or it wasn't, but this was how people perceived it. And over time, you know, now we're kind of middle ground. And I think that's a great place to be because there's a friendly quality to our beer. We've added a tiny bit of, like, Simcoe to the beer only as frosting. You know what I mean? And I say tiny, it's like, you know, if there's, I'm going to get this number wrong, but I think if there's like 10 pounds per barrel of dry hopping, it's like a half a pound of a Simcoe, you know? But because you need to be part of the current, like, spectrum of flavors, but this is essentially the same beer on the alcohol and the malt base and the essential bittering and stuff. And so I thought it was the future because I could see how much people liked pale ales, and I knew that if I sold up, people would only like some number of people would only like an IPA a little bit better, and that would be a world. But when you think about what the top of the pile is, you know, look, Bud Miller and Coors and Heineken and Corona, everything. Don't they all make pilsners? You know, I mean, I guess some are Vienna Lager if you look at the Mexican ones, but. With their pilsners, which was the top of the world spectrum as far as lager making went. Now, whether they were the world's best lagers anymore, who knows? You know, it's a matter of opinion. But pilsner was the top of the tree. You know, so
to get back to hops, you might want to talk about relationships with the hop farmers that we've been able to develop over the last few years and our barley farmers.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird little thing, but you know the world of. So craft brewing is born into the world that existed before us, and the world that existed before us was built to supply Bud Miller and Coors, and domestically anyway, and Pabst and whatever other large scale brew. But these guys used adjuncts in the malt, and they didn't use very much in the way of hops. In fact, a lot of them preferred extract because they were more generically flavored, so they weren't susceptible to from year to year kind of flavor differentiation. So then the beer changes when the hop change. We all expose ourselves to that. Well, you know. that made all of those inputs commodities. And the truth of the matter is, when it comes right down to it, malting quality barley is not a fucking commodity. It's a highly specialized value-added product. And the farmers that grow malting quality barley, it's a matter of great pride that they know how to do that. But yet, it got priced along with feed barley, which could have been anything. I mean, the crummiest stuff that, you know, that just only an animal's can eat. And so our goal in that, as is was true for hops as well, was to decommodify those things, was to recognize them as truly value-added products and try to separate the old ways of buying that the big brewers would employ from the way we buy. They would buy as commodities, we would buy these as specialty products. And we've been working hard and long with we have barley farmers now up in Alberta, all up and down from north to south Alberta, feeding the RAR plant in Alex, that are growing malting quality barley in the field from the day one of planting for us at a knowable price, you know. And so they don't do anything to the least bit to hedge their bet against it becoming feed if something were to go wrong at harvest. They know what's going to happen. They know where it's going to go, and they make the best malt that possible. Same thing for the hop farmers, it's a big change for them to start thinking about their products as not commodities. Most of the hops that are grown up in Yakima, Washington are grown for alpha acids, which means they get made into extracts. And then any brewery, just like we do at the Hop Stupid, you just pour it into the kettle. You know, it doesn't have any particular flavor. It's just really bitterness. You're buying pounds of alpha acid. But things like Simcoe and Citra and Amarillo Galaxy is even now, you know, from abroad. I mean, you know, these are extraordinarily specialized products that require a lot of skill to grow. And we want to pay more for them to encourage the farmers to do more of that. And the farmers are seeing us eye to eye. We haven't renewed a contract with a hop dealer in 3 or 4 years now. You know, so everything we're buying is coming directly from the farmers. And the farmer, you can almost feel them sigh a little bit of a relief when they know they're talking directly to their customer. They're not growing hops anymore, they're growing beer. You know what I mean? Yeah. They feel like they're directly, they know what, when they do it, who it's going to go to, what they're going to do with it, and how it will be perceived.
Well, that's inspiring. And even as you expand into Chicago, are you going to do the same thing?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Are you going to keep the same farms? Are you going to move to farms in the Midwest?
Nope, same farms. You know, the malt being made in Alex, Alberta, which is outside Calgary, it's almost equidistant from there to San Francisco as it is to Chicago, so... You know, nothing will change. You know, it's going to be great. And my hope is that, like with brewers in the Chicago area, you know, there's a lot of smaller brewers there that we can begin to kind of maybe wrap them into some of these programs with us, that they can benefit, and the hop farmers, the malt barley growers, you know, that they can all sort of, you know, begin to expand their exposure to craft brewing in a more enlightened way.
Well, you have a great vision. I'm really glad you came on. Going back to talking about how, you know, you grew your company. You know, tell us about the handoff from you to your current brewer now. What you went through, you know, when did your current brewer start working for you? How about that?
Jeremy started working with us probably in 2002, I think, you know. And he came in just as a kid right out of school, but he was a bright light right from the start. And he was just a staff brewer working the cellar, working filtrations and doing stuff. But he was, you could just tell there was, you know, he's a strong, strong thinker, very, very careful thinker. And, I mean, I'd describe him as more of a jazz musician than even a brewer. You know, everything in his life is, he approaches it with that sort of sense of open-mindedness and a little bit of wonder and excitement. So it is that... That he was writing the recipes, and when we poured it over from our 30 barrel brew house, which was extraordinarily manual, it's like most breweries, you know, dragging hoses around, opening valves and stuff, to the 80 barrel automated system, you know, I worked with Jeremy to make sure that he was the head brewer by that point, to make sure that he understood and that the manufacturer of the system, Rolec, understood that we didn't want the system to make beer. We wanted it to move the brewer to the highest level of decision making so that they could be concerned about times and temperatures and flow rates and pounds and gallons, you know, and they can really watch they can mind the computer, you know, which is stupid. But, you know, having a brewer stand there who has to run up and down the platform to connect a hose here, then he knows 5 minutes later he has to be over there to close a valve, you know, he's not, his intellect isn't engaged. He's tired. He's working, to move, make all this stuff happen. So for so we did that, and in doing that, I could just see Jeremy knew exactly what we were doing. He learned a lot about our recipes, certainly, you know, because I was writing them for him and describing them how what we wanted to have done, and how I wanted the beers to turn out. And when it came time to particularly to write the Hop Stupid, up until that point, we really hadn't used a lot of Simcoe, any of these new varieties. We were old school, Centennial, Liberty, you know, Cascade, Willamette and such. And I didn't know enough about the new hop flavors. I said, Jeremy, here, you're hip to these, you know, because I'm a younger guy, you know, I'm getting old as time goes by. And so it's like, here's what I want the beer to be, you know. This was the test case. I said, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to have the residual gravity here, I want the alcohol here, I want the apparent bitterness to be like this beer, only a little bit. And he read my mind, and he the beer that I imagined, he created. And with that, I started feeling a lot of confidence in him. So I still art direct recipes. You know, I have an idea of what I think we, where you know, whether we should go to the bridge or go to the next verse, you know, I direct him that way. But he takes it and runs with it and makes it his own. But it's all sort of in the Lagunitas vocabulary of flavors at the same time. So it's cool.
Well, that's awesome. That's a little insight into how you've grown your company.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to seeing what happens in Chicago in 2013.
Thanks.
And it's really been great having you on. Just want to say, again, thanks to Lagunitas. Thanks for coming on. New York City, it's 2012 is coming to an end. Want to know the best places to ring in 2013? Go to goodbrewseal.com and check out our calendar to find out about craft beer events at 41 of the best beer bars in New York City. And New York City Craft Beer Week, you remember that? Well, it's coming back. It's going to be New York City Beer Week in February of 2013. Many of the New York City breweries like Six Point, Brooklyn Brewery, Kelso, joined together and formed the New York City Brewers Guild, and they will be bringing back New York City Beer Week. Learn more about it at goodbrewseal.com. I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. You can find Beer Sessions Radio on our Facebook fan page, Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. You can also follow us on Twitter at @beer_sessions. Thanks to Tony and Mark from Lagunitas for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and our engineer, Joe Galarraga. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. Merry Christmas.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.